You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 8th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Anthony Lowenstein, author of The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. And later in the show, Remenda Cyrus of The American Prospect joins us to talk about the predatory lending epidemic in the United States. Meanwhile, the stolen documents special counsel's office indicates to Trump's legal team an indictment's coming soon, maybe. This comes as Mark Meadows' testimony for the grand jury is passed. The Trump team thinks he's a key witness. Remains to be seen if he flipped on the big guy. The Freedom Caucus tantrum over the debt ceiling deal continues, shutting down House business for a second day. Comer walks back his bluster, canceling the contempt vote against FBI Director Christopher Wray in the Hunter Biden Kabuki theater probe. I guess the deep state got to James Comer. Shockingly good Supreme Court news. They rule 5-4 that Alabama must redraw their congressional map to represent black voters. Fox News accuses Tucker Carlson of breach of contract over his Twitter show. I like that. Biden vetoes the Republican bill to stop student debt cancellation. His fifth veto as president. Jobless claims at their highest since October 2021. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you, Fed. Louisiana is the latest state to ban gender-affirming care for minors. Only one Republican defected. A federal investigation into child labor at meatpacking and produce plants expands, stretching to 11 states at this point. Hundreds of leftist leaders around the globe have signed a letter warning of a soft coup against Gustavo Petro in Colombia. And lastly, evangelical broadcaster and former Republican presidential candidate Pat Robertson, dead at 93. And Sam's out today. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. As a reminder, Pat Robertson was a raging homophobe who said 9/11 was brought upon the United States because of our sinfulness with pornography.
Yeah, because Real World had a gay person on.
Yeah, we're the only place that has gay people in it in the United States. I think he also, we were punished for our sinfulness for gayness and pornography. That makes sense.
There is a clip we should maybe play in the fun half of Pat Robertson in like 2013 being more accepting of trans people than 99%.
We played it before.
Yeah, 99%.
And Pat Robertson was a lunatic.
Yeah, I don't think he... I think the only thing that explains that old Pat Robertson clip is he didn't understand how useful attacking trans people would be to the right later on.
Yeah.
He thought that was lost.
But why that's useful is that you can see how this is so trumped up and right. Inauthentic.
Yeah, it's not that the left has been pushing it on it. It's just that the right decided it was going to start getting upset.
Yeah. Well, we will talk more about Pat Robertson, I think, in the fun half. But wanted to highlight this insanity from Laura Ingraham's show last night. She spoke to Steve Milloy, who is some crank. I guess.
He's a respectable man on the Laura Ingraham program.
Well, he's wearing a tie. Not particularly well. Looks a little crooked, but, you know, I'm not the...
What, the tie or...
I'm not the what's that leftist guy on Twitter who critiques right-wing fashion?
Workwear?
Yeah, I can't speak to it, but...
So per Wikipedia, Steve Malloy is the founder and editor of junkscience.com. Mm. And
his
career has been spent disputing the science government agencies rely on for protecting the public.
Right.
Yeah, so you'll see a lot of that here, and that's why Laura Ingraham brought him on. Because yesterday and into today, tens of millions of people in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic were essentially under air quality alerts, and the severity here in New York City was as bad as it got, I think, in the country. We had an AQI of 484.
Yeah, off the charts, like at 300, I think, is where they say, like, hey, it's hazardous to be outside.
Yeah, and other areas surrounding the city also had some really hazardous air quality. Apparently, Eric Adams said at the press conference it was the worst that it's been since the 1960s, the highest worst air quality level recorded since that time. But here is Laura Ingraham's guest, Steve Malloy, to tell you that it's actually no biggie.
Look, the air is ugly. It's unpleasant to breathe. And for a lot of people, they get anxiety over it. But the reality is there's no health risk. Okay, there's EPA research. They've done lots of clinical research on asthmatics, on elderly asthmatics, on children, on elderly with heart disease. Not a cough or a wheeze from any of them. We have this kind of air in India and China all the time. No public health emergency.
Speaking of, do you notice, like, in all the coverage of, you know, Bill Ware, the tailpipes, all this stuff, they never, ever mention the fact at the top that China is the number one polluter in the world. Never.
Yeah, this
Wait,
is
hold
like
on, though.
In China.
Pause it for a sec. So what is it? Is it a bad thing that there's pollution, or is it a good thing that there's pollution?
Yeah, like, we...
Then why are we hitting on China if it's actually no biggie? And there's no quality... Let's pull up these statistics that we have here. Go ahead, Matt.
I mean, this is just from one statistic. Like, in 2017, 1.24 million people died in China according to air pollution.
India is the second in this. This is done by the University of Chicago. They have an air quality life index arm. And, you know, University of Chicago, not known to be a Marxist leftist organization. Yeah. India, ranks like second worst, essentially, in terms of pollution. Mm-hmm. And you see there, 5 years gained in life expectancy, potentially, if the air quality index is met. Yeah. Scroll down even more here with India, because this is just absolutely absurd. India is today the world's second most polluted country. Air pollution shortens the average Indian life expectancy by 6.3 years.
Yeah, India and China are fine, right?
Relative to what it would be if the World Health Organization guideline was met, 3.4 years relative to what it would be if pollution were reduced to meet the country's own national standard. Now go to China here. China's actually improved recently. There are 9 out of 240 at this point. But they so if air pollution was to be reduced to WHO guidelines, it would be a 2.6 yearly gain in life expectancy. If it were to be met. And
And just to clarify, like, what Laura Ingraham is alluding to, like, why are people, they bend over backwards to apologize about China. The thing about China and, like, fossil fuel consumption, for instance, is, like, presently they emit a lot. It's a massive country, and they are industrializing, which we had the benefit to do. And so, like, it's not a real comparison to say, hey, we're a lot cleaner in terms of our industry. It's because we've deindustrialized and been through all that.
And we also have less population and per capita historically. Before we have implemented some incredibly threadbare climate standards, the United States per capita was the worst polluter in the world.
For decades.
So now, let's go back to this, because it's both, like, not a problem if China pollutes, and also let's hit China on it, according to Laura Ingraham.
I mean, it's really bad. They in the winter, they never turn on their scrubbers for the air pollution because they don't care. Weir has no idea.
Can you go back like
10
seconds? I just want to see how a former Trump era transition team climate person. That makes total sense. I just want to get to that part where she brings up China.
And on elderly with heart disease, not a cough or a wheeze from any of them. We have this kind of air in India and China all the time. No public health emergency.
Speaking of, do you,
Sorry, just pause it real quick. No public health emergency. That is a political choice to ignore the actual impacts.
All the coverage of, you know, Bill Ware, the tailpipes, all this. They never, ever mentioned the fact at the top that China is the number one polluter in the world. Never.
Yeah, this is like clean air in China. I mean, it's really bad. You know, they in the winter, they never turn on their scrubbers for the air pollution because they don't care. Weir has no idea what he's talking about. This doesn't kill anybody. This doesn't make anybody cough. This is not a health event. This has got nothing to do with climate. First off, this is wildfire smoke. This is natural. This is not because of climate change.
Oh, my God. Pause it again. It is 100% due to climate change. This is a really difficult concept for Steve Malloy, so I'm going to break it down for him. There are going to be more wildfires as the globe heats up because the forests become more dried out and the brush lights on fire more easily. So you'll see more wildfires, more intense wildfires, and wildfires in regions that typically wouldn't experience them during this time. Yeah. So it's completely related
like,
to climate
they're like,
change.
Oh, yeah, it's just the ecology. Like, climate change, if it happens, which I'm not admitting it will, if it does, it'll just mean the ecology will change. Like, how do you think that happens?
Yeah.
Where do you think those trees go? Do you think they just, like, disappear? Or do you think, like, the new heat, like, might create a combustible atmosphere? And he cited the EPA once, so let's go to that as a source. Multiple studies have found that climate change has already led to an increase in wildfire season length, wildfire frequency, and burned area.
To make anybody cough. This is not a health event. This has got nothing to do with climate. First off, this is wildfire smoke. This is natural. This is not because of climate change.
It's
not because of fossil fuel, you know, internal combustion engines. He just has no idea what he's talking about.
All day, by the way, it seemed like the media figures that we've become accustomed to seeing on television during these crises, they seemed like they were back in their element and kind of almost enjoying the moment of wearing masks again, didn't they? They seem to have a little pep in their step with those masks. Now, they talked about the dangers of something called particulate matter from the smoke. Here's CNN earlier.
Consider wearing a mask, and that is because of the particulate matter in the air. This is among the tiniest, most dangerous kind of pollutants, and it's the kind of thing found in this wildfire smoke. These particles are so small they can get into the lungs when you breathe them in, get into the bloodstream, and cause all kinds of health issues.
Steve, we're back at the masks. Ramin Askwi is watching from heaven, by the way. Ramin, I know you are. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is crazy. This is all particulate matter, but particulate matter was not a concern until EPA invented it in the 1990s, and they've been riding it, the Obama administration, now the Biden administration.
Well, what is it? Is it a health concern?
No, particulate matter is very fine soot.
Well, you don't want to be breathing that in all day.
They're just carbon particles. They're innocuous. Just, yeah. Okay, by them, they're innocuous. There's nothing in them.
Even Ingram.
They have no effect. The EPA has all this testing just on real live human beings. It shows no effect. This is total junk science.
Yeah, oh my God, man.
Psycho.
How do you live with yourself? I mean,
remember chimney sweeps, Laura?
Yeah.
They were fine.
I mean,
carbon.
The black lung, totally invented by the woke left. I mean, I know that's a different thing, but there's a reason that people experience health hazards, and it's because, but it is the same thing in that instance, right?
Yeah.
That's more localized to workers in mines, but these are all like the damaging effects of our addiction to fossil fuels and other polluters. And people are going to bear the brunt of it and already are in terms of body counts, health hazards, deaths. And this is just a propaganda effort to downplay it. Even Laura Ingraham's like, should we be breathing in soot? There's nothing wrong with it.
I guarantee you, neither of them spent a significant amount of time outdoors yesterday. If they did, they had a mask on.
Oh, no. Like, town car to Fox, town car to home.
Exactly. And like the idea that... I saw even like some like supposedly lefty people saying like, oh, you guys love the mask now. If you were here, you can feel it in your throat even if you're inside.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely feel it when you go outside. The idea that, okay, I have these masks around, I'm just going to leave that alone. Like, you are the sheep. You are the morons.
You guys there's no smugness about the mask. I wore the mask outside.
This.
Yes, I wore a KN95. I went to the gym and I walked in and even when I was wearing my KN95 and I was indoors, I could still feel heaviness in my breath.
Yeah, now,
because of being out in the soot air.
Do I think it's going to kill me? No, I trust the like sort of estimates that say that's like basically being out there like in that environment an hour is similar to smoking a cigarette.
Yeah,
I believe that, right? I still don't want to just have that in my lungs. Like, it's just ridiculous. Please give me a mouthful of this just because it's nature. I don't want to be like these mask wearing diaper faced cheap.
Well, that's because you're idiots. A soft little soy boy liberal who doesn't want soot in their lungs. Last thing to put up from this UChicago thing, this final, because guys, we're having fun with this, but this is going to be the new normal in a climate change world. We've already passed the point of no return for a lot of these effects, but this is the kind of effect that particulate pollution has here. The University of Chicago AQLI says, working unseen inside the human body, particulate pollution has more devastating impact on life expectancy than communicable diseases like tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS, behavioral killers like cigarette smoking, and even war. I mean, I don't know about that war point exactly, because it's difficult to quantify. But, like, there you see, smoking. It's less than when the PM2.25 relative to WHO standards.
No, this is propaganda for polluters. This is disguised as like some sort of media critique, and we're like, look at the pathologies of liberals. But this is this is like basically straight from Koch brothers type of like the attack, the type of people who are funding the attack on the EPA through like the courts and stuff like that. That's the exact same people who are putting the words in these two cretins' mouth.
Yep. All right, guys. Quick word from one of our sponsors, and then we are going to be speaking to Anthony Lowenstein. But one of our favorites, Sunset Lake, Sebede. Sunset Lake is celebrating dads this year. Regular dads, dog dads, and even plant dads. Plant daddies, you might call them. Save 20% off your order at Sunset Lake Sebede with coupon code DADHAT. One word, DADHAT. Orders over $100 will get a free Sunset Lake Sebede dad hat included with their order. Now, I don't have one of their hats, but the Sunset Lake t-shirt is one of the softest t-shirts I possess. It's one of my favorites. And so I can speak to the quality, at least of their t-shirts. I imagine the hats are kind of similar.
I have a hat from they sent us over some product a few maybe last year or the year before. It's a black hat with the red Sunset Lake logo, mm-hmm. and it's one of my favorite hats. I wear it to concerts. It's a great fit. So yeah, I would definitely encourage you guys, if you need some Sebede, get a hat with it.
And if your dad needs some to calm down, go for it. The sale starts today. It started at 6 a.m. today, and it goes through Monday, June 12th. At 11:59 p.m. So celebrate your dad getting some smokables, some salve, some arnica, some gummies if he has trouble sleeping. Those are a nightly use by me with the melatonin in them. It's time to celebrate the dads in your life and get them a brand spanking new Sunset Lake Sebede dad hat with the rest of the products that you use. If you order over $100, you will get that free Sunset Lake dad hat. Today until the 12th, saves 20% off on all Sunset Lake Sebede products with the coupon code DADHAT. And that is not all. Orders over $100 will get a free navy blue Sunset. Okay, I just repeated that. But yes, you'll get the dad hat, and it's navy blue. That's what you need to know. Again, this runs
the official color of dads.
It really is. That's on their uniform. Monday, June 12th at midnight, up until midnight. That's when the sale ends. So at 1:59 p.m. on Monday, June 12th, use the code DADHAT to save 20% off your order, and orders over $100 will get the free hat. All right, guys. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Anthony Lowenstein. We are back, and we are joined now by Anthony Lowenstein, best-selling author of the book The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. You also might know his book Disaster Capitalism from a few years ago. Anthony, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For sure. So this is not your first book about Israel either, right? Your book, My Israel Question, came out in 2006. What motivated you to approach this book and write about Israel again, but approaching it from this new angle of like Israel's integral role in the military-industrial complex and the surveillance technology that it's kind of become quietly infamous for exporting?
I've been visiting Israel and Palestine for close to 20 years. I've been going every 3 or 4 years. I've been reporting from the West Bank or Gaza and Israel. And between 2016 and 2020, I was living in East Jerusalem for a number of years. And I think when I was there, although I'd been hearing about Pegasus, the infamous spyware that some viewers will know that you can basically hack people's phones, I was sort of starting to realize that having done a lot of reporting on other conflicts, Afghanistan, South Sudan, Honduras, those conflicts, as horrible as they are very geographically placed. They're in those countries, within those borders. But the occupation in Palestine actually is exported. It's now the weapons and the tools and technologies that Israel is using to maintain that occupation, 56 years and counting since 1967, is a brutal occupation that requires huge numbers of intelligence gathering, spyware, smart walls. And I felt like there was a need to sort of do the bigger picture. As you said in your introduction, my work on disaster capitalism kind of gave a sense of people making money for misery, essentially. And the occupation of Palestine, which is now the longest occupation in modern times, is a massive money earner for Israel. And as someone who is Jewish, although secular and anti-Zionist, I thought it was important to not just look at it politically, but also question where the Jewish state, in my view, has gone so fundamentally wrong.
Well, I mean, that's an important thing to flesh out here, because so much of the portrayal of being anti-Zionist is, in at least here in the United States, it means that you're anti-Semitic or that you're anti-Jewish in some way. And it's, I think we're becoming clearer-eyed in differentiating that, because as you write about, you know, we'll get into the book in a sec, but I'm just curious, do you think it's reductive to call Israel a proxy for U.S. and Western imperialism in many ways? I mean, they've become their own entity in and of themselves, but I feel like that's a useful way for some people to understand the dynamic at the outset, at least.
I think Israel is a client state of the U.S., but it's also more than that. So yes, there's no doubt without the U.S. support, and this doesn't really make much of a difference, to be honest, whether there's a Democrat in the White House or a Republican. I mean, in some ways with Trump, there was much more honesty about how the U.S. viewed Israel. I mean, Biden's been in power now for 2 years. Nothing has changed. Nothing will change on this issue, sadly. There is a lot more discussion in the Democratic Party, to be sure. There's actually a kind of civil war of sorts over Israel-Palestine in the Democratic Party, to the point where this year, for the first time in a Pew poll, a majority of Democratic voters were more sympathetic to Palestinians and Israelis. That's a shift. It's never happened before. So you don't see that represented by Kamala Harris or Joe Biden. They're very pro-Israel, whatever that means, which I would argue is actually anti-Israel, because it's not being critical about what Israel's doing with the occupation. But Israel also has its own identity, has its own, obviously, mission. And what you find in the last decades, as I show in the book, is that many times Israel is selling weapons and training and technology, even to countries that the U.S. won't sell to. I mean, the U.S. sells weapons to anyone. I mean, they are the world's biggest arms dealer by far. But Israel will basically, I think, take that to the next level. And while still claiming to be, you know, a moral army, a moral country, a light unto the nations, an inspiration for not just Jews, but people around the world. And I think their actions, as I expose in the book, really make a mockery of that, frankly.
I mean, Israel, I didn't even realize at this point, 10th biggest arms dealer in the world, despite its really, like, relatively small population. So, I mean, I think that would come as a surprise for some people, but, and also given the fact that Israel insists that U.S. aid for its militarism is essential to maintaining the country's existence. But how did we get to this point where Israel has become such a dominant actor on the global stage in terms of arms sales and also surveillance technology?
I mean, the short answer is end with the occupation. Just like the U.S. was testing weapons in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11, such as the West is now testing weapons in Ukraine with the Russian invasion of their country. So on one level, it's not hugely unusual for war zones to be testing zones for new sophisticated technology and spyware and surveillance tech. But the difference with Palestine is that Israel has in its backyard, essentially for half a century, an occupied population. So to control that population, to manage them, to dominate them, you have to develop huge numbers of so-called counterinsurgency techniques, both human intelligence and obviously in the modern age, digital intelligence. And what I show in the book is that so many countries in the last 50 years, although it's accelerated since 9/11, have gone to Israel because they want that those tools and technologies, but also those so-called tools of counterinsurgency. So we look at the dirty wars in Latin and South America in the 70s and 80s, where some regimes like Guatemala are committing actual genocide against their indigenous population. Israel's assisting, training, arming, helping out. Why? Because the Guatemalans at the time wanted those experiences. They saw what Israel was doing in Palestine, and they wanted to do the same thing in their own country. That's one example amongst so many. So what I guess has happened here over decades is that what Israel has done, it's testing huge number of weapons in Palestine itself. What I mean by that is drones, surveillance, in the modern age, facial recognition, biometric tools, all these sophisticated tools and technologies to control Palestinians. And then they sell them as battle-tested. They actually say that, both as a government and Israeli companies, to huge numbers of countries around the world. And as I show in the book, we know of at least 130 countries, so the majority of nations in the world, in the last half century that have bought some form of Israeli surveillance as democracies and dictatorships. And often those nations, as an example, Saudi Arabia, a close Israeli ally, not an official friend, but certainly a close ally now, is desperate for Israeli spyware and defense tech. UAE, Bangladesh, I mean, literally can list pretty much every repressive regime in the world. And of course, those countries use other countries' defense technology as well. It's not solely Israeli often. But what Israel has is, as I said, when you have an occupation and a occupied people in your backyard, you have an endless supply, an opportunity to test weapons and test tools. And post 9/11, that was on crack, because when the US launched its own war on terror after 9/11, it was basically the Israeli playbook, not just the actions, but the rhetoric. And I explain that a lot in the book. What I mean by that is that when America was claiming to fight terrorism and its collateral damage and all this language that's become so normal for us now in the West, Israel had been doing that for decades against Palestinians in Palestine, or Palestinians in Lebanon when they were occupying from 1982. So in some ways, Israel wrote the playbook, and that playbook is very attractive to many, many nations that want to do something similar in their own backyard.
Well, I mean, not to put it too cynically, but it's like Israeli militants is vertically integrated, or that their technology is, because they're able to test these things in real time, which is
absolutely
kind of as disturbing as it gets. You know, you spoke about Guatemala there, but some of the other revelations in your book are really important to flesh out historically, just how Israel was working with these dictatorships or with death squads in Latin America in the 70s, selling weapons to Pinochet in Chile and others. Talk a bit about that history and how, you know, like that very much laid the groundwork to make Israel kind of the weapons and technology behemoth that it is today.
I mean, there are so many examples. So let me give you a few. Rwanda, literally during the genocide in 1994, selling weapons to the Rwandan regime. In the more modern era, Myanmar, which in the last 5 or 6 years has also committed genocide against its Rohingya population. The UN found that a few years ago. Israel was providing technology, weapons, and spyware. As I said, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bangladesh, the Philippines during Duterte's, the former leader's term there, that was committing huge numbers of abuses against alleged drug users, 30, 40,000 people killed. Israel was a key ally. And in some ways, as I said, one of the key relationships, which I talk about a lot in the book actually, is between Israel and apartheid South Africa. That regime ended in 1994, so it's history. Actually, it's incredibly relevant today because they didn't just have an alliance based on defense. They wanted to buy weapons from each other. South Africa was desperate for uranium, and thank Christ that never actually happened, because South African apartheid with a nuclear weapon is a pretty scary thought, as is Israel for that matter today.
Well, we can just look into the future and see that, right?
Exactly. But, and of course, Israel has 200 nuclear weapons as we speak, if not more.
Yeah.
But there was also an ideological alignment there. They both saw themselves on the front lines against barbarism. So obviously in Israel, it was against Palestinians. South Africa, it was against blacks. And you had Israeli leaders, including Ariel Sharon, a former Israeli prime minister now dead, who went to South Africa back in the day during apartheid and deeply admired their so-called bantustans, you know, this idea of quasi self-ruling black townships, which essentially is exactly what Israel is now doing in the West Bank. South African apartheid was a key model for Israel, and Ariel Sharon himself acknowledged that. He admitted that. His aides have acknowledged that. Now, the reason all that might seem like ancient history, but actually it's very relevant, because one part of the book I talk about is that Israel has become an inspiration, not just because of its defense, but also as an ethno-national state. That a nation that is a Jewish supremacist nation in the 21st century. And which nation particularly is inspired by that today? India. India is the world's biggest nation now, world's biggest population, surpassed China this year, world's biggest self-described democracy, although I would question that.
Mm-hmm.
And what India is doing is not solely based on what Israel wants. Of course it's not. But it's relevant because Modi, the leader of India, is now very close to Netanyahu, the leader of Israel. They don't just share a defense relationship. They also share an ideology. In India, of course, it's Hindu fundamentalism. And let's be clear, the US and my country, Australia, is now cozying up to India because they're not China. China is the bad guy. India is the good guy. But India actually, under Modi, is looking in some places, and you have senior leaders of that regime calling for ethnic cleansing against Muslims. Indian officials openly, I talk about this in the book, openly admiring what Israel's doing in the West Bank and wanting to do similar things in Muslim areas of Kashmir. In other words, Israel is a model. Israel is becoming a model. And India, as I said, as the world's biggest democracy, if they see Israel as a model, we should be a little bit worried.
Certainly. I mean, and this is a deep ideology for Narendra Modi. He rose to power as a Hindu nationalist and in opposition to the Muslim minority. There's an ideological parallel with Israel, which is deeply troubling. And obviously, I feel like those parallels are even starker too when you bring them domestically to the United States. I mean, you quote in your book Richard Spencer, the infamous white supremacist in the United States, basically praising Israel as a European settler colonial state. And the through line, I've got to say, is just this deep hatred and fear of brown people and Muslims more broadly.
Absolutely. And I wanted to mention about the far right, because for many viewers, they might think, why would you have a far right person who traditionally doesn't like Jews, could be a neo-Nazi? And when you go to these far right rallies, and I've been there for work purposes, that's the only reason I would go, they often wave the Israeli flag. People might think, sorry, what, waving the Israeli flag, they don't like Jews. The issue is not Jews. They don't like Jews. What they do like is the concept of a, as you said, a European-style settler colonial state that proudly prioritizes Jews. Now, they, of course, want to create a Christian ethno-state in the US or parts of Europe or wherever it may be. So Richard Spencer, as you quote there, also called himself a white Zionist. And that really sums it up. Doesn't like Jews, doesn't want to be like Israel, but admires what Israel has done for Jews, what he wants to do, and many, many others, for Christians in the US, as I said, or elsewhere. And what's so disturbing, and I say this as a human, but also as a Jew, is that Israel is developing relationships with the far right, not distancing themselves. I'm not talking about particularly Richard Spencer, but the idea of far right regimes or parties around the world, in Europe and elsewhere, that Israel is developing relationships, wants to have those relationships, parties or groups that don't traditionally like Jews. And that endangers all of us, obviously non-Jews, but definitely Jews. And it's remarkable to me that, you know, 75 years, a bit more than that now, after the end of Second World War and the Holocaust, and many Jews, including me, had many our family members killed in by the Nazis, like, this is our legacy, our being Jew, like this. I mean, I'm a non-religious Jew, but this is the legacy of the Jewish people, to have an Israel that proudly associates with anti-Semitic groups or regimes. That needs to be called out and challenged, because, frankly, I know in the US particularly, there is still in some places an unease, right, about being too critical of Israel, even talking about Israel in a critical way, which is reflected, with some exceptions, in your Congress.
Yeah, with very few exceptions. And the ones that do speak out, like Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, are essentially smeared as anti-Semitic.
Absolutely.
And in Ilhan Omar's case, stripped of her committee assignments when the Republicans take charge, or yeah, at least, yeah. I mean, the repercussions are dire, even though I think there is a good understanding among younger people that is a lot more aligned with what we're talking about, and just the reality,
yes,
of Israeli occupation. That's the glimmer of hope. But I wanted to ask if you could expand on some of the phone hacking technology that you touched on earlier, particularly Pegasus, which helped the Saudis hack Jamal Khashoggi's phone, and has been sold to other countries and regimes across the globe. And I also know that they had a different firm, I believe, an Israeli surveillance firm, that sold to Putin, and that he's been using it against his opponents for a long period of time. But just, what are these groups? What are these companies? What is their utility?
So yeah, Israel has become notoriously, as you said before, some of the most known, infamous spyware companies in the world. Pegasus is the most famous, by a company called NSO Group. And it's important for viewers to know that most of these defense companies, their genesis is from men and women who have come from the Israeli military, often the intelligence, the so-called Unit 8200, which is like the NSA, essentially, in the US. So they've spent years and years and years working and honing their skills and tools and technologies on Palestinians, which they then take to the private sector. Pegasus is infamous. As you said, it's been used by, we don't really know the number, but no doubt dozens and dozens and dozens. Saudi Arabia, Mexico, would you believe, is the biggest user of Pegasus in the world, not just in the past, but still today under its nominally left-wing government there. It's remarkable. Like, you see, countries become obsessed with this technology. You want to listen to your enemies, your dissidents, your human rights activists, your journalists, your political opponents. It's so easy, not that expensive for a state to buy. And there are lots of other companies that are existing. The one you mentioned with Putin is Cellebrite, which is not as known, but is still just as effective. again, developed by people who used to work in the Israeli intelligence services. Cellebrite operates in basically virtually every U.S. government department, do you believe? It's used by Putin's Russia. It's used by China in China, but also in Hong Kong, Belarus, lots and lots of regimes around the world, in Australia, my country. And its most known use is a police department wants to hack into a person's phone who's a suspect, and Cellebrite allows them to, you know, hack into an iPhone, essentially. And look, there are times, obviously, where an individual may be doing horrible things, alleged pedophilia, and frankly, you know, I don't think by definition these tools are immoral by definition. The problem is that all these tools and technologies bleed into various other parts of society. They don't stay where they're designed. NSO claims it's only used to go after terrorists and pedophiles. What's nonsense? It ends up being used by regime after regime after regime to go after their enemies. Like, this is how it works. And at the moment, there's no real regulation in anywhere in the world because no country wants to regulate it, right? Because every country wants access to this technology, including the US. A few years ago, the US administration, when Biden came in, put a censor on NSO group, which on the face of it seemed great. They were said to be abusing human rights, and the US pledged to crack down on this. Well, two problems with that. One, the US government's still using it. Oops, so there's that problem. And secondly, I saw this very much, not so much that the US is against spyware. The US doesn't want its own industry to be challenged. This is the problem that more and more countries face, that Israeli spyware particularly is now some of the most dominant in the world. And the US wants to see itself as the self-described global hegemon as beyond reproach, right? So if any other country like Israel, even though Israel is a friend, nominally, and I say this in the book, right, that Israel and America have a weird relationship. They're close, they're intimate, they love each other, sort of. They also don't really trust each other. Every day, the NSA has roughly 400 Hebrew speakers spying on Israel. Every day. And I can assure you that works both ways. So they're friends, but they don't trust each other. This is how it works. And that's important for people to understand because there's so much debate which you hear constantly in the US is Israel's our closest ally. We have shared values. I just heard it again this week. Sorry, what are these shared values? Shared values of what? Backing occupation or apartheid? Like, what is that shared value? I mean, that's what it is, right? But so spyware's become intimately connected to Israel's dominance in this industry around the world.
How much of it, too, is the fact that this spyware is so widely sold to a variety of different countries? How much of that is designed to prevent Israel from making themselves pariahs because they have their kind of finger in every pot, so to speak?
It's a big factor. Two reasons for that. One, I see so much of this technology being exported almost as an insurance policy, that Israel's aware that many countries don't like what it's doing in Palestine, but they believe, and history would suggest with some justification, that sure, a nation might put out a terse press release if there's more settlements in the West Bank, but they're desperate for Israeli technology, for spyware. So that's part of it. And I think also there's this idea somehow that Israel is, you sort of said before, not so much beyond reproach, but is able to, I mean, it's important viewers understand, these Israeli companies like NSO Group are only private in name only. They're essentially arms of the state. So when Netanyahu and the Mossad in the last 10 years has often gone to nations they want to befriend, Saudi, UAE, Rwanda, and I track this in the book, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months after Netanyahu visits country X or vice versa, they're using NSO Group's Pegasus. That's not accidental. That's how you make friends, right? I mean, they're transactional friendship. I don't think it's particularly, you know, I wouldn't say as much love there, but there's a transactional nature to it, right? So, and of course, because these companies are essentially arms of the state, Israel therefore has intelligence access to all the information that's coming in through these tools. So when they're selling it to India or Saudi or UAE or whoever it may be, Israel's listening. And the US, of course, listens to the NSA as well, right? But this is how it works.
And this is my last question because I know we have to let you go. But, I mean, like, we saw this report out of The Intercept a few weeks ago. I believe Ken Klippenstein broke it, how there was U.S. intelligence showing that Israel was considering bombing Iran and that the United States didn't have a good handle on what those plans entailed. Thankfully, someone leaked this to Ken, so that makes that does a good job of squashing it to a degree. But, like, they're rogue at this point, and yet they have completely unconditional funding from my country. How have you observed in, you know, you've been a journalist and writer for many years now, this emboldening of Israel through their now lucrative technological firms and weapons industry, and the fact that there is seemingly no tangible recourse outside of criticism from lefties like myself for the apartheid and the occupation?
I mean, the one word is impunity. Israel has impunity to do what it wants. It has for decades. I mean, the sort of slight element of hope here, because I'd like to leave it with a bit of hope, is, as I said, public opinion actually is shifting. As I said before, Democratic voters, the majority now support Palestinians over Israel. In the Jewish community in America particularly, there is an absolutely really, to me, necessary civil war going on. It's a nonviolent civil war within the Jewish community. That is vital. There is, it's mostly young versus old. It's a bit more complicated than that. But in short, younger Jews much more critical, older Jews much more supportive of Israel, pushing their community and their so-called leadership to not give carte blanche to Israel. And if that relationship breaks or is severed or is challenged, Israel has a problem. And of course, there's obviously a growing, I think, willingness and openness in the American media to have Palestinians on, to hear a Palestinian voice. Social media, which I talk about in the book, how it's often been censored by Israel and Israeli-affiliated organizations, is providing, despite all that censorship, still an unfiltered reality. You go onto people's, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, whatever it may be, people can see the reality of occupation. You can't really control that. It is what it is. People can see it. And I think that does contribute to a growing shift in public opinion. Like with apartheid South Africa, without outside pressure, this won't change. You know, Israeli Jews won't wake up one day and say, this occupation's pretty awful. Of course, there are Israeli Jews, some of them who oppose it. Obviously, there are. But they're very small. And in fact, the young Jewish population in Israel, in fact, they're getting more right-wing, not more left-wing. So without outside pressure, which I think is slowly starting to happen, despite the massive, almost insurance policy over weapons, there is some hope. We have to have some hope.
Well, I appreciate that note leaving off there. I could use it. Anthony Lowenstein, the author of the book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. We will put a link to your book in the description on YouTube, podcast, and at majority.fm. I would encourage everybody to check it out. Anthony, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
For sure. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Ramenda Cyrus. are back, and we are joined now by Remenda Cyrus, the John Lewis Writing Fellow at the American Prospect, whose piece is called Predatory Lendings, Prey of Color. Remenda, thanks so much for coming on today.
Hi, Emma. Thank you so much for having me.
For sure. So, you know, you tell a really important story here, predatory lenders, often payday lenders. You start your piece and continue through it, like kind of being the emotional heft of it, the story of Miss Lily, a woman who was targeted by predatory lenders. Let's start there, if you don't mind, because her story is really a typical one when looking at these kinds of issues.
Absolutely. And it's funny that you call her typical, because as we were writing this story, one thing that we kind of came against was her story is atypical in a lot of ways. But the thing about it is that it's so prominent that it's an example of how easy it is to get into these type of situations. So Miss Lily is an older 70s woman who, she was working, you know, which I think is the most tragic part of it. Like, she was working, she had a full-time job, she made decent pay to her perspective, and she just couldn't afford like her rent 1 month, you know? And so she had gotten an offer in her, directly to her mailbox for like a, you know, like a, it's like a small dollar loan is what it's called. It's not like less than like $1,000 or so. And it's typically indicative of a predatory lender. So she got on the bus, she couldn't drive, she got on the bus, got that loan, and it kind of sent her into a cycle of debt, when that's really common here in America.
Yeah, I mean, some of these payday, I mean, they're really the bottom of the barrel in terms of just like how they entirely exploit their consumer base. And I might conflate accidentally payday lenders with predatory lending, but those do, payday lending is the primary, I would say, or one of the primary predatory lenders in this country. Can you explain what the scope of predatory lending is, including the payday lending bulk of it as well?
Sure. So a predatory lender is typically something that's called an alternative financial service provider, an AFSP. It's basically a service provider, a money lender, usually, that exists outside of the traditional web of banking that exists here in America. So Chase, Wells Fargo, Citibank, those are all often brick and mortar traditional banking services that have regulations, that have a lot of history here in America. So they're very reliable. And not just that, but they are very safe to get loans with. And so pawn shops, credit check cash in places, predatory lenders such as payday lenders, they all exist within this web where they're relying on essentially a vacuum within the financial web of the country where brick and mortar stores are leaving and closing, brick and mortar banks such as Chase are leaving. And now these predatory lenders come in and take that place because people have to get money somewhere a lot of the time. The simple fact is that people working in the country often don't have enough money to just make their ends meet, make their rent, get food on the table, pay their regular bills. And so they feel forced into this situation where they don't have access to a traditional credit line. Maybe they have bad credit. In Miss Lily's case, she didn't have bad credit, but she had fallen behind on her traditional banking payments, and she wasn't able to access that line of credit, and she needed money quickly, which is another, you know, people in that situation often just kind of find themselves there, you know? So it's very prominent and very common in the country.
And what you write about, which I was not aware of, is how these communities tend to be, as you write, bank deserts, where there aren't these kind of more traditional financial service entities. And so it allows for predatory lenders to be predatory and take up that space. And so just by sheer proximity, they are more likely to be in majority-minority communities based on, like, I mean, clearly they have some data that they want to exploit.
That's exactly it. Yeah, they know that, you know, the working class, poor people, and in a lot of ways, it's simply the way the system has come together. But predatory lenders rely on knowing exactly where people are going to need them the most, And they know that that's these communities. So it often ends up being poor, working class, people of color.
And just exacerbating the cycle of debt. I mean, we've talked about this on the show before. It's just the being, when you're rich, you get a lot of things for free. You're able to access lower interest loans. You're able to avoid a lot of the potholes that are set up to trip up poor or middle class people in this country, and it compounds upon itself. And this was clearly a story of that. And, you know, Dodd-Frank was supposed to attack and target predatory lenders, right? Yeah. In the wake of the financial collapse. What happened to defang that? And I know a lot of it has to do with Trump and his completely grinding of the CFPB to a halt. But if you don't mind just taking us through that period of time from 2010 when Dodd-Frank passed to where we are at now with these predatory lenders.
Sure. So the Dodd-Frank Act created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a critical bureau that it does exactly what it's called. It protects financial consumers from predatory lenders, from bad customer like rendering, things like that. So after Dodd-Frank was really focused on subprime mortgage lending. So that was a big part of it. And subprime mortgage lending has, to a certain extent, gone down, and it kind of pushed it to the shadows. But even that still existed. So the CFPB was essentially set up to handle everything else from there. So when Trump got in office, you know, he was in office just 6 years later. And this was in the making beforehand. It was the crash was precipitated on the subprime lending that people were content to do, you know. So when he got in office, it was just the culmination of a crusade, if you will, sort of like a lot of things that we've seen, but a culmination in just the effort. So in 2016, the CFPB issued a payday lending rule, and that payday lending rule was essentially just completely taken all the meat out of it. It was supposed to provide something called underwriting provisions, sort of like an ability to repay rule, which is just they're supposed to make sure that people can pay back the loans. And that was like a critical piece of this. And another portion is that they were supposed to no longer be able to like pull out funds just indiscriminately, you know, if they were getting declines. There were a lot of pieces that went into this payday lending rule that essentially would have just knocked the payday lending industry, you know, out of kilter. So they took to the Supreme Court, or they took to the court in two different cases. One was to essentially take away the power of the CFPB by forcing the director of the CFPB. It was supposed to be like you could just fire them for something like for cause, you know, but the Supreme Court ruled that that was for some reason unconstitutional. And that put, thankfully, that put Rohit Chopra in office, but that was the end of one of the parts to take away the power of the CFPB. So in this vacuum that's like been created, because the CFPB is fighting for its life right now, it doesn't have any bandwidth, essentially. It's now that under Biden with Rohit, there's more, but it's still, you know, fighting court cases, and everything is under extreme skepticism. So the CFPB is essentially unable to do its job. And then there was another court case where they took specifically to target that payday lending rule that I was mentioning earlier.
Right.
And between those two things, the CFPB just hasn't been able to really make progress. I mean, Dodd-Frank was passed like, you know, 13 years ago now. And that's just not like, you know, the CFPB could have done a lot of time, but we were severely stunted, could have done a lot of work, but we were severely stunted in like the first half of the game.
And people would not be shocked to know that that court case that you just mentioned was sent to the Fifth Circuit, which is an incredibly extremist right-wing circuit court in this country. And of course, now they've essentially stripped the CFPB of even more of its power. And I guess the Supreme Court is going to hear The appeal, when would that be?
That case is pending. It's supposed to just be its next session. So it's just pending right now. The next session, I'm actually not sure exactly when that is now, because I think it's been pushed a little bit, not just the session, but the case itself. But it is pending. So right now, there's nothing essentially happening, but the CFPB also kind of has its hands tied, because right now the question on the table is this organization itself constitutional? That's like the ultimate question. And the crusade.
Of course it is, but
not.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it is. But that's the crusade, right? Like, it's not constitutional, and very, like, it's wild to me that the alternative to something like the CFPB, you know, which, you know, isn't perfect, but has been considered, like, extremely successful in what it has been able to do. It hasn't been able to do everything that it's been, like, supposed to be able to do, but what it has done, it's been, like I mentioned, subprime mortgage lending has, you know, decreased a little bit. So it has done what it was supposed to do to some extent. And the alternative to not having that agency is just allowing payday lenders, predatory lenders in general, to just have free reign of, you know, any market they want to enter. You know, it would be very deregulated, essentially.
And already, I saw the statistic in your piece that Black people in this country are twice as likely to live near these small dollar lenders, and that they're thus more likely to use them. And so this kind of financial service exploitation is in desperate need of government regulation. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the Biden administration has been way too hands-off in its approach to letting the courts kind of delineate how things are going to go. And so until we hear a ruling from the Supreme Court on this matter, which I don't have optimism about, this kind of stuff is going to keep going on.
Yeah, and as you said, the driving force of the piece is really the emotional heft of it. It's just so important to emphasize the desperation people feel, and then the stress that it puts them under when it's something as simple as, you know, trying to pay your rent or trying to put food on the table. And it's entirely like a system of our creating, you know, like these systems that we put in place have led to here, and the people that are, you know, suffering are the people that often always suffer, you know. So I can't see a solution where the CFPB is unconstitutional and we don't have anything in place, because that would really just make the situation a lot worse.
Absolutely. Well, we'll put a link to your piece in the description wherever you're listening to this, and at majority.fm. Ramenda Cyrus of the American Prospect, the piece is called Predatory Lendings, Prey of Color. I'd encourage everybody to check it out. Thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Emma.
For sure. All right, guys. With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program, head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Tuesday we had Elks Hockley on to talk about the sort of weird space we are and the post-Bernie left populism moment in terms of, like, globally, too. We also talked with Ben Burgess and Gene Bajelon about Cornel West entering the race for president. So patreon.com is Left Reckoning. For rural listeners, Keith Orihal, we're talking about rural America and its place in capitalism for patrons. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning on Sunday.
And on ESVN, we spoke a good amount about the Heat Nuggets series.
I'm sure you guys did a great job, but nothing goes out of date faster than commentary on, particularly when it's down to one series and you can't talk.
I was going to avoid me saying it's out of date now, but it's a little out of date now. Yeah. But the other topics we talk about, less out of date. I mean, we spoke about Dalvin Cook, which was incredibly prescient. We basically predicted what happened today, so you can check that out. He got cut from the Vikings, which is a bizarre decision. And we spoke about the horrors of horse racing and what it means ethically to have this sport be legal in this country, as horses are dying at an insane clip, getting pumped allegedly with a bunch of different drugs to perform for oligarchs. So, yeah, not great.
You know, it's not the thing that I would focus on in terms of, like, the horror of this country. But it is something to note. And, like, when Black Beauty came out, like, the 1870s or 80s, it was basically about, like, oh, yeah, the sort of, like, wanton destruction of horse flesh is something this country was one part of the what made this country. Just, like, horses dying in crazy amounts. Like,
God, I don't even I remember that book, but I don't remember the plot.
I haven't read the book, actually, but I knew, like, that was the motive behind it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also a really good lens to look at sports gambling, the anxiety that they feel getting less money about that because they're going people are betting on regular sports at this point, and how that's kind of a cauldron for this brutality that we're seeing too. But do we have our friends here, Brandon and Matt Binder. Hello, Full guys. House. Whoa.
Hello.
Hello. Good to have you back, Brandon.
Thank you.
What's happening over on the discourse?
Well, I put out an episode of the Patreon a few days ago about, you know, being targeted. I almost said Tarjay being Tarjayed, but that would be inappropriate in these trying times. You know, DeSantis's launch on Twitter being a debacle. Oh, and also I give my thoughts on the new Fast and Furious movie.
Oh,
there's a new Fast and the Furious movie?
Fast X,
yes.
Yeah.
We haven't done
beginning of the end.
No. I feel like, but isn't it a three-parter? How can you do Fast 10 three-parters? It's got to be Fast 11, Fast 12, Fast 13.
No, it's going to be Fast 10, Fast 10, 2, and Fast 10, 3.
10, 3. Gotcha. That makes a ton of sense.
Right.
Well, Matt Binder, hello. What's happening on your two wonderful shows?
It's actually, I have show one and show one, two.
Perfect.
On Doomed this past week, on Tuesday, actually, at youtube.com/Matt Binder, and it'll be up shortly at doomedcast.com. I had on journalist David Bixenspan, and we talked about the sports washing going on with Saudi Arabia and the WWE and the PGA Tour. And then we also took a deep dive into the latest updates on the drama surrounding Lauren Boebert and the idea, the potential that her father was a pro wrestling legend by the name of Sweet Stan Lane. There's updates there. You should check out the podcast to find out what those updates are. And then on Scam Economy, coming up this weekend, probably Sunday, maybe worst case scenario Monday, but the interview is already in the bag. I'm having on Molly White on the show, same place, youtube.com/Matt Binder, and at scameconomy.com for the podcast, to talk about the SEC going after the two largest crypto exchanges, the largest in the U.S., Coinbase, and the largest in the world, Binance, and what that means for the future of crypto, at least in this country. So you can check that all out on my various different platforms coming up now and later this week.
All right. Well, check those out, guys. And we are going to head into the fun half now, where we will take your calls and do some clips, maybe even related to that Saudi Gulf live thing that you just touched on. There's an insane interview with Bryson DeChambeau. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you then.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
Black.
Come on!
Black.
Come on!
Black.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.